today at Reader's Corner, CNN's national security analyst Peter Bergen, author of Manhunt, The 10-Year Search for Bin Laden, From 9/11 to Abbottabad.
I, like anybody who'd been following bin Laden for many years, was very skeptical of the idea that he'd be in a cave, but I was surprised that he was living in central Pakistan. There was no love lost between al-Qaeda and the senior Pakistani officials. It's very hard to prove negatives, but I don't see any evidence that Pakistani senior officials knew where bin Laden was living. One of the big puzzles of all this was why he didn't fight back. He had about 15 minutes to fight back, either pick up the two guns that were in his room or to conspicuously surrender, and he didn't choose to do either of those things.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The night he was killed, Osama bin Laden heard strange sounds inside his compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. He quietly told his youngest wife, "Don't turn on the light." Those were the last words he would utter. Moments later, a team of Navy SEALs made their way to his top-floor bedroom and shot and killed the United States' most wanted man. Peter Bergen's book, Manhunt, The 10-Year Search for Bin Laden, From 9/11 to Abbottabad, is a thrilling account of the raid on bin Laden, as well as a detailed record of the CIA's decade-long search for the elusive terrorist leader. Manhunt was released on May 1st, the one-year anniversary of bin Laden's death. I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Bergen to Reader's Corner today to discuss his latest book. He was a guest on our program in April 2011, just 3 days before bin Laden was killed. During that interview, we discussed bin Laden and the shadowy world in which he operated, not knowing, of course, that U.S. intelligence had identified his likely hiding place and that a daring military operation was about to unfold that would result in his death. Peter Bergen is one of journalism's foremost authorities on bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Along with his work at CNN, he is the director of the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., and a fellow at Fordham University's Center on National Security. Mr. Bergen joins us today from the studios of the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. Peter Bergen, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you for the invitation.
Well, Peter, it was one of those moments for me where when I heard the news, I thought, why couldn't I be talking to Peter Bergen today instead of 3 days later? and of course, in your book, one of the things you point out toward the end of the book is what a great job the White House did, the highest councils of government did, in covering up what was going on, right down to the fact that they shut the White House down for the normal arrival of guests that occurs every day, the tours of the White House. Obama gave his big funny speech taking on Trump at the press club dinner the night before. No one had the foggiest idea. What about Peter Bergen? Did you have any clue, even in retrospect, as you look back, could anybody have figured out what these guys, what was going on and that this was about to pop?
I didn't have any idea. And in fact, I had sort of come to an erroneous conclusion that in 2010, it seemed to me that the trail had really gone cold, that there were no leads. And you know, unbeknownst to me, in August of 2010, a very small group of people at the White House and a very small group of people at the CIA did have a lead. But as you say, this was very closely held. You know, on the day of the raid, President Obama, as is his usual kind of pattern, went to play golf, but he only played nine holes. I mean, they went to great pains to kind of maintain a business as usual profile. The weekend of the raid was being planned. And also they went to great lengths to kind of keep this very tightly compartmented. You know, Tom Donilon, the national security advisor, has said there's only one way to keep a secret in Washington, which is don't tell anyone. they just didn't tell anybody, really. I mean, a lot of people, senior people in the White House, didn't know whether it was, Valerie Jarrett, who's President Obama's, you know, one of his closest advisors. Anybody who didn't need to know was not told.
So given the background of your work on bin Laden, were you surprised at the fact that when they did finally get him, they got him in Abbottabad, not too far from Pakistan's answer to the West Point, and a suburb of Abbottabad? Did that surprise you?
Yeah, I mean, slightly. I mean, I, like anybody who'd been following bin Laden for many years, was very skeptical of the idea that he'd be in a cave. We'd had something like 30 videotapes and audio tapes from bin Laden after 9/11. They were full of references to recent news. He seemed to be kind of watching TV, listening to the radio. When he did produce a videotape, his clothes are well pressed, and caves don't tend to have laundry facilities. So clearly he was living somewhere comfortable. And I, like many others, thought perhaps he was along the Afghan-Pakistan border in a compound very similar to where he was hiding. But I was surprised that he was living in central Pakistan. But it makes sense, because this is an area where bin Laden, for many years, had good reason to think that the United States would not mount an operation and would not be looking for him in this area.
One of the things that really struck me about the book was your sources. I mean, there's just not anybody in Washington who came anywhere close to this crisis and had a hand in it that you didn't track down and get some account, some perspective. And some of them, I suspect, are weighing in. As I read some of the quotes, I thought, well, yeah, that's what I'd want people to think of me if I'm giving the post event quote on what went on. I guess what interests me more is, what about the folks who didn't? Was there anybody you didn't get to comment on, where you had to piece together your own analysis because they just wouldn't talk?
Well, the big omission is I wasn't able to get an interview with President Obama, who obviously is a very busy guy. You know, on the plus side, 60 Minutes had done a quite detailed interview with him immediately after the event. And then the History Channel had done quite a detailed interview with him and made available the full transcript to me. It's still a regret that I, well, because there were some questions, obviously, that I, having spent years reporting on bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and also traveling to Pakistan three times to report on this particular event and getting inside the compound where bin Laden died, you know, it would have been great to speak to President Obama directly. But, you know, that said, I obviously spoke to quite a number of folks in the White House, a lot of them on the record, a lot of people at the Pentagon, many of them on the record, people at the CIA, most of them off the record because that's the way CIA does business, and other people in the intelligence community, because, of course, the CIA wasn't the only intelligence organization involved in all this. And so, you know, one's able to, even with the absence of having President Obama or having a sit-down interview with him, you know, I was able to speak to many people who were in the room with him when these decisions were made, when he was debriefing the U.S. Navy SEALs 5 days after the successful attack on bin Laden. President Obama met with the SEAL Team 6 guys who led the attack, and they briefed him on the operation.
Well, you were the only journalist and independent observer to gain access to bin Laden's Abbottabad compound before it was demolished in February of this year. First of all, how'd you manage that? And secondly, maybe you can give us just a rough description of what you saw.
I've been visiting Pakistan since 1983, and my wife has also done a fair amount of journalism in Pakistan. And so we went together and met with senior Pakistani officials. I went another couple of times and basically, you know, just kind of was very persistent. And they demolished the compound 2 weeks after I visited it. I didn't know that that was going to happen, but clearly whoever let me in probably had a sense that that was going to happen. And they probably calculated they needed some independent observer to go in, that it would be to their benefit in some way. And they know that I have a history of reporting on this subject. They regard, I think, myself as a straight shooter. And I think they wanted to show the compound. Now, what did I see? You know, this was a squalid suburban compound in the middle of a small to medium-sized Pakistani city. I knew a lot about what had gone on that night when bin Laden was killed before I entered, and I also had a pretty good sense of what bin Laden's life was like because I was able to talk to some Pakistani investigators who talked to people who'd survived the attack. But getting on the compound itself, Bob, helped me kind of conceptualize about how bin Laden was really living, because there's nothing like the physical evidence. I found, for instance, a bottle of Just for Men hair dye in his bedroom, Pakistani version. So he was, you know, he was dyeing his hair for media appearances. He was living in this bedroom with a much younger wife, 29-year-old at the time that he died. She was 29, he was 54. He had a tiny little toilet, not much larger than a closet, small kitchen. Each of his wives had her own small kitchen. They were living sort of cheek by jowl. It was a big compound, but there were also 24 people living on the compound. They were growing their own crops, cucumbers, that kind of thing. They had cows, which they were milking. They had bees, from which they were making honey. They had chickens. It was kind of a rudimentary lifestyle, very no air conditioning in a place that gets reasonably hot in the summer, very limited heating in a place that gets pretty cold in the winter. And, you know, the overwhelming impression was one of sort of squalor, I would say. You could see the physical evidence of the SEAL raid, which was, you know, very intense. There was a lot of broken glass, one massive metal gate which prevented access to these floors on which bin Laden lived in the main residence that had been blown through. You could see the explosive marks on the on this large metal gate. And I went into the bedroom where bin Laden lived and died, lived there for most of the 6 years of it, the last years of his life, and was killed there. And it was a sort of relatively low slung ceiling, 7 feet. Bin Laden's 6'4", so it was kind of cramped. It had windows that could look out on a small terrace. The small terrace had very, very high walls. So bin Laden had kind of constructed something that it was very hard to see in, but it was also very hard to see out. So the night of the raid, he must have been very confused about what was going on, because while people couldn't see in to see him, he could not see out to see what was happening. And one of the sort of big puzzles of all this, Bob, is why he didn't fight back. He had about 15 minutes to fight back. The first helicopter crash happened within... The helicopter crash with the SEALs on board took place in the first few seconds of the raid. That's a noisy event. There was also a firefight brief that he would have heard. And, you know, he had 15 minutes to either pick up the two guns that were in his room or to conspicuously surrender. And he didn't choose to do either of those things.
So there were like 29 people in this compound. And how many were killed? Was it 8 or somewhere around there?
Every military age male was killed. Bin Laden, the two bodyguards, his 20-year-old son, a female, a wife of one of the bodyguards was killed. So 5 people were killed, mm-hmm. and then 2 people were wounded. One of the courier's wives were wounded. And so total of 7 adults, mm-hmm. 5 killed, 2 wounded.
So where are the survivors? Where's the family members today?
Good question. And it's interesting how few people ask that question because, you know, there were a lot of survivors. The wife of the bodyguard, I think, is probably in Pakistani custody. She survived, or maybe she's out now, but no one's talked to her. And then bin Laden's 3 wives and the dozen kids and grandkids spent a year in Pakistani custody. And then around the first anniversary of bin Laden's death, they were basically flown to Saudi Arabia. 2 of the 3 wives are Saudis, and they are living there under the protection of their families.
Is there any doubt in your mind that the brass, somewhere in the brass of the Pakistani military, they knew where bin Laden was?
Actually, you know, in the book, I say it's very hard to prove negatives, but I don't see any evidence that the Pakistani senior officials knew where bin Laden was living. Mm-hmm. The reactions, you know, the United States was, U.S. officials were talking to the Pakistani military that night. They were listening to the Pakistani military communications. No one, you know, everybody was surprised, had no idea. We have recovered thousands of documents from bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad. They've all been translated. There's no smoking gun pointing to some Pakistani official complicity. Al-Qaeda had on 2 occasions tried to kill General Musharraf in 2003. At that time, the Pakistani military dictator stroke president. So there was no love lost between Al-Qaeda and the senior Pakistani officials. And I don't think there's any evidence that they knew or were harboring bin Laden in any kind of, you know, there was no complicity here.
You're listening to Peter Bergen. He is the author of Manhunt, the 10-year search for bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. Peter, let's go back to the hunt, and we'll fast forward through the first phase. In 2005, there was a special bin Laden unit at the CIA that was shut down, and that probably had something to do with the Iraq war ramping up and how many resources and energy can you direct in how many directions. So now in 2006, there's a new effort, and you talk in your book, this is fascinating for me, about a major cultural shift at the CIA. And from watching those old spy movies, all you saw was older white guys that were either doing the intelligence or boots on the ground. But you talk about a number of women who played a role on this new task force in getting to the point where they figured something out.
Yeah, I interviewed a senior CIA operations officer who joined in the 70s and who retired, you know, relatively recently. And he said the biggest cultural shift that he saw at the CIA was the role of women, that when he started, there were very, very few women as operations officers. It was basically kind of a misogynistic culture. And women have played an increasingly important role at the senior levels of the agency. And they played a particular role in the hunt for bin Laden because the guy who founded the bin Laden unit, Mike Scheuer, in late 1995, early 1996, particularly wanted to recruit women. He felt that they were better analysts, but they saw patterns better, understood relationships better. And certainly women have played a key role in this story. One of the women analysts in 2005 wrote a memo out laying out the best approaches to find bin Laden that was sort of influential in the way people processed the intelligence they'd already gathered or collected new intelligence. And, you know, obviously men played a role too, so I don't want to overstress this point, but it is something that has shifted at the agency quite dramatically in the last 20 years.
Was that the memo where she identified the courier approach as one way to track where he might be?
Yeah, in 2005, a sort of younger female analyst wrote a memo saying, there was kind of a realization at the agency in 2003, 2004, that there was going to be no magic detainee who was going to give up the information about where bin Laden was. There was no detainee who really knew where he was. There was going to be nothing was going to drop out of the sky about where bin Laden was living because there was no signals intelligence on, he wasn't using cell phone, email, that kind of thing. People in his immediate circle weren't motivated by cash rewards. And so she wrote a memo that was entitled Pillars, and she said there are four pillars on which we should sort of position the hunt. One is bin Laden's communication with his family. Two, bin Laden's communication with other leaders in al-Qaeda. Three, bin Laden's communications with the media, Al Jazeera in particular. And four, just focusing on the courier network in general, because he obviously was communicating somehow because messages were getting out to the media, so it had to be by hand. And the first three approaches never really yielded much. Bin Laden's immediate family was either with him, traveling with him, as it turned out, or not communicating with him at all. Communication with other leaders of al-Qaeda didn't really yield anything. They were never able to trace back in the chain of custody of tapes going to Al Jazeera back to bin Laden. And so you're left with a courier network, and I quote General Mike Hayden, George W. Bush's CIA director, who served briefly under Obama, that going after the courier network was really kind of a bank shot. It was a way to find bin Laden that wasn't going after him directly. Find the courier, and then you hope to find bin Laden. And that's basically the approach that the agency pursued.
So how did they find the courier being this Kuwaiti? How did that happen? What went wrong with the way they were communicating or currying?
Well, bin Laden faced a dilemma, which is, you know, if he said nothing, communicated with nobody, he would still be alive today. But if he wanted to retain some kind of control over al-Qaeda and also communicate with the media, he had to get messages somehow. So the courier became the key. And a good chunk of my book is taken up with the Agatha Christie story about how this courier was discovered. But suffice to say, there was no one breakthrough at all. It required, first of all, the identification of this guy, Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, which means the father of Ahmed from Kuwait, as somebody within al-Qaeda. That came in the course of, probably in the course of a coercive interrogation in 2002. It required then somebody 2 years later saying that this guy is actually a courier. It then required finding his real name in 2007 because Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti is an alias. It then required connecting this real name to a cell phone in a particular city in Pakistan in 2010. And then it required sending people on the ground to track this guy back to Abbottabad because he was practicing very careful operation. It wasn't enough just to have his cell phone because he would take not only turn the cell phone off but take the battery out about an hour away from where he lived. So it was a kind of combination of some information from interrogation, some information from a foreign intelligence service, very likely the Pakistanis, classic signals intelligence, and then human intelligence, spies on the ground.
So even when we get to the point where we know the Kuwaiti is showing up in this compound in Abbottabad, there's still this concern in Obama's inner circle. What's the percentages? Help us understand this discussion regarding the percentages. And in fact, I think the red team comes in here. They actually get this group of people to do a second look at, is he really there? And what's your take when it's all over on what kind of percentages they were working with?
Well, the percentage is very interesting. One of the more interesting anecdotes in the book, I think, is President Obama has a meeting with Mike Morrell, who's the deputy director of the CIA, and asks him, why do some analysts say there's a 60% chance that bin Laden's in Abbottabad, and others say there's a 90% chance? And Mike Morrell says, basically reflective of how much these analysts have either been on the bin Laden hunt exclusively, those people tend to have a higher degree of confidence this is bin Laden, or those people like myself who lived through the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction fiasco and are naturally quite skeptical of circumstantial cases. And then he says at one point, Mr. President, in terms of the amount of data available, there was a better circumstantial case that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction than the circumstantial case that bin Laden's living in Abbottabad. And so for anybody who sort of thinks this was an easy call, I think that's a rather telling kind of anecdote, because if I was president, that would give me a lot of pause. This was an entirely circumstantial case. And the other thing, Bob, which I think is important, is it's easy for an analyst to say, well, there's a 40% chance he's in Abbottabad, or there's a 90% chance. But at the end of the day, when you make a decision, he's either 100% in Abbottabad or 100% not. There's no, at the end of the day, you have to make a call based on imperfect information, which is, I think, true of a lot of kind of classic presidential decision making. I mean, it's a very different kind of decision. But when Kennedy made the set of decisions he made during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which took place over 6 days, he averted a nuclear war by making the right set of decisions. President Obama, the stakes were lower, and this was a decision that took place over 10 months. But there was imperfect information. There were enormous risks attached to the decision that he actually made, which was sending people on the ground. There were also risks, by the way, in doing nothing, because the longer you did nothing, the more likely it was to leak out that this, that bin Laden was living there. That, of course, he would have left immediately, or he might have just left anyway. And the intelligence picture, President Obama understood by the early 2011, the intelligence picture was never going to really improve. It was the only way to improve it was to take real risks on the ground that would basically reveal the fact that you were surveilling the compound in a really obvious way that would spook the inhabitants, and then they would leave.
And when you say, you mentioned sending people in on the ground as part of the decision, that was the other major decision that President Obama had to deal with, because basically there were four courses of action he could have chosen. Help us through, and again, we don't have a lot of time to do this, and I'm sorry to throw this at you. That's a question that takes a chapter or two in your book, but help us understand how he could throw out the other three anyway.
Well, the bottom line is it was really four. There's one, a B-2 bombing raid. When they looked at that, it would require 35 bombs, 500-pound bombs, going off to destroy this compound, which would, like somebody pointed out, would be like a small earthquake in a medium-sized Pakistani city. So that was dismissed pretty quickly. The second option was a joint operation with the Pakistanis. That was contemplated and then also rejected because of concerns that the information would leak in some way. Third idea was a drone strike using a small experimental munition, which had never been used in combat before. The objection to that was similar in some ways to the B-2 bombing raid. The B-2 bombing raid, there'd be no proof that you'd kill bin Laden. There'd be no evidence collection at the scene. The drone strike, the drone might miss. But on the other hand, you didn't have people on the ground. And obviously, having U.S. Navy SEALs on the ground, there could be a firefight with the Pakistanis, civilian casualties, bin Laden not there, much less likely to be a covert operation that you could deny if something went wrong. And of course, it did go wrong, and one of the helicopters crashed early on. So you had to sort through all these decisions, and eventually President Obama went with what was arguably the riskiest proposition, but the one that had the greatest chance of success in the sense of proof that bin Laden's dead, intelligence collection at the scene, and if you're lucky, no American casualties, no Pakistani casualties outside the compound. And that's what happened.
Any surprises as you did these interviews and you learned more about Hillary Clinton taking a fairly hard stand about going in, and Biden being against going in, and Secretary of Defense Gates being against going in, Mullen being in favor. As these folks stack up, any surprises in retrospect? Like, wow, I wouldn't have expected that person to take that approach or whatever?
Well, I think, Bob, one of the surprises is, you know, Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, usually were on the same side of any
right.
argument, whether it,
yeah.
whether it was, you know, supporting the surge in Afghanistan or other debates that happened in the National Security Council. So here, you know, when Obama made his final decision, Joe Biden, the vice president who got into the Senate when President Obama was only 11, was against. Secretary Robert Gates was against, who started working in the Nixon White House when Obama was 13. General James Cartwright, who's the number two military advisor to the president, was advocating the drone strike. So, you know, that's a pretty heavy group of people saying, you know, don't do this. On the other hand, Leon Panetta, CIA director at the time, was for. Hillary Clinton was for. Mike Mullen was for, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And many of the other people in the room at lower levels in the National Security Council had also, either that day during this meeting or earlier, had expressed the fact that they were in favor of the raid. You know, it was a kind of very mixed picture.
We have time for one more question, Peter, and I'd like to ask you a question that relates overall just on this narrow issue of presidential timber, presidential metal, when it comes to making a decision like this. I wonder if you could just comment on what you were able to take away from this in terms of Obama's role and how he pulled this off.
One of the things I say in the book is I think President Obama is a calculated risk taker. When the rewards are very high, he's willing to take quite a large risk. Taking on Hillary Clinton as a junior senator from Illinois, you know, that was a calculated risk. Going after Gaddafi within 9 days, as he did, a calculated risk. This was a calculated risk. I mean, there were some risks in doing nothing, because the longer you waited, the more this likely this would leak out. But there were also some, you know, the easier thing would have just been to do the drone strike, or, you know, there were people advocating that at the National Security Council meeting on the last day, that he just before he made this decision. I think that this is one you cannot take away from him as being something that he got right. It was risky. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was his decision. That's the way our system works. It's not, he has, the National Security Council gives him advice. He's the one who has to go back to the residence on Thursday, April the 28th, 2011 at 7 p.m. at night, and then 13 hours later come out and say to his National Security Council team, it's a go. But that's his decision. It's no one else's. Mm-hmm.
Peter, we've run out of time. I'm delighted that we had this time together. I thank you very much for the book, for being on the show. I remind my listeners, and they know that I don't say this every week, you've got to read this book. We can't cover in a half an hour what's in this book. And if you care about this country, and if you care about the challenges we face around the world, this is a book that puts it all in perspective. Peter Bergen, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you, sir.
As a final note, I'd like to remind our listeners that the 29th Annual Frank Church Conference on Public Affairs is Tuesday, October 16th in the Student Union Simplot Ballroom at Boise State. The conference, titled Afghanistan After America, features a keynote address at 7 p.m. by Ryan Crocker, the recently retired U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, as well as presentations by a number of distinguished speakers during the day. The conference is free except for the luncheon and a reception, and the public is invited. Details are online at frankchurchinstitute.org. Next week, Gary Gallagher, author of The Union War. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.